MENA Watch, der Talk.
Ahmed, I'm very grateful that you come here and spend time with us for this interview. Let me first give some information about you. You are born 25th of April in 1990.
And 24th.
24th.
Yes, Wikipedia has it wrong.
You have to correct that.
Yes, and I was born in Saudi Arabia, but yes.
Yes, it's coming. It's coming. Your family is originally from Gaza Strip, but you were born in Saudi Arabia because your father worked as a United Nations physician. Your family returned to Gaza in 2000, and your father began working at the Jabalia refugee camp. At age of 11, you were caught in an Israeli airstrike during Second Intifada, which left you with permanent hearing loss in one ear. Mm-hmm. 2005, at the age of 15, you participated in a one-year-long U.S. Department of State-sponsored cultural exchange program. There, you attended sessions with Living Room Dialogue, a Jewish-Palestinian group, marking the first time you spoke to Jews or Israelis. Mm-hmm. After that, you applied for and received political asylum in the U.S. because you could not return to Gaza, since the Second Intifada was still dangerous. And there you finished high school, City College, and the University of San Francisco. In 2014, you became a U.S. citizen at the age of 24. And in 2023, you earned a master's degree in intelligence studies at American Military University. Currently, you are a Palestinian-American humanitarian activist and author and a senior fellow at Atlantic Council think tank in Washington. Your main subject is the political and humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip. Now, I would like to know, you have a history of negative incidents with Israel. When you lost your hearing, three of your friends lost their lives. In 2017, while attempting to visit your sister and parents in Israel, you have been deported from Ben-Gurion Airport. In the current Israeli-Hamas war, you say you lost 30 of your relatives. So how come you still advocate Israel, trying to build bridges, pursuing regional peace deals such as with Saudi Arabia, and say that negotiations should run parallel?
Well, thank you again for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. And that was a pretty impressive, I would say, chronological order, given that it was collected in bits and pieces online. It is precisely those lived experiences and the hardships and the pain, both physical, psychological, and otherwise, and the loss of family members that motivate me to pursue an alternative future for both of our people, certainly for the Palestinian people. I consider myself very pro-Palestine. I care about the Palestinian people's aspirations for freedom and independence. I want my people to have prosperity, dignity, safety, just as I believe the Jewish people in Israel should have safety, security, and that those two things do not have to be in opposition. They have been framed in opposition and as mutually exclusive. And I think the only way forward is to kind of deconstruct that in the sense that there is space and capacity for both of those things to be true at once. I get regularly asked why I believe what I believe and say what I do, despite the fact that I have faced those hardships personally and through family members. And to me, I'm blessed in that I have done personal work to be able to take an emotional step back and realize that this is bigger than just myself. This is about two peoples, and that there will always be instances and incidents. Obviously, I'm talking about my personal side, and there are what's happening in the war right now is horrendous, and it's awful. And what took place on October 7th. Was a disaster of epic proportion for Israelis and Palestinians alike. And that's what makes me see through Hamas's propaganda. But despite the fact that there will always be incidents incidents that somebody like myself gets caught up in, this is bigger than myself. And I have Western privilege in that I got out and I built a life for myself.
So what do you think should happen? What kind of deal needs to be implemented in order to end the current war? And what could be done to build on a long-term solution to end the decades-old Palestinian-Israeli conflict?
Well, that's certainly something I spend a lot of time every day thinking about. And I think the most immediate need is to stop the war. And that does not mean allowing Hamas to go back to the October 6th reality in which they can not just threaten Israelis, but hold the Palestinian people in Gaza hostage to those nefarious designs and plans of their own to be part of the so-called axis of resistance. But I think the most important need right now is a ceasefire hostage release deal that allows for the return of Israeli hostages, that allows for, even if it's gradual, for the end of the fighting. But in order for that to be successful, and again, I say stopping the war and having that initiate political transformation for the betterment of Gaza's future and prospects, that will require immediate steps to plan. What does that look like? Is it a combination of Arab and international policing coupled with Palestinian Authority monitoring, coupled with UN peacekeeping, coupled with, there needs to be a transitional period that needs to entail, that needs to be multilateral. It cannot just be the Palestinian Authority alone because they're incapable. It cannot just be an international peacekeeping force because that risks it being seen as a form of occupation. I think it should entail a cocktail, if you will, of Arab nations, moderate Sunni Arab nations like Jordan, like Saudi Arabia, like the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait and others. But I also think the European Union, for example, I've called for elements of the European Union to be a part of this transitional period. There's no shortage of scenarios that can be implemented. The other thing that people have to realize is that there will need to be some form of rehabilitation or recycling for some of what remains of Hamas. Israel, after a year now, has not been able to eliminate every single Hamas member, nor is that really attainable. We have seen examples in previous war zones where there are several models for demobilization, demilitarization, and reintegration. And so we need to be creative, we need to be courageous, we need to act fast to save what can be saved of Gaza, to hopefully save the lives of Israeli hostages, many of whom I've connected with their loved ones and their family members. And I've said from the beginning to a lot of the pro-Palestine community, I put in quotes because that's such a loaded term that means different things to different people, but I've said, couple calls for a ceasefire with the release of hostages. And unfortunately, there are Palestinian detainees who are held unjustly, but I don't think we need to create a moral equivalency with how Hamas has retreated, obtained those hostages, women and children who had no business being held hostage, with what the Israeli military is doing.
So do you have, besides that, an internal vision of how the Palestinian society could be reshaped? I mean, now that the head of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar, is dead, is there any kind of change that you can imagine for this society?
Well, I don't think the change is so much tied with Sinwar, but what gives me hope, what makes me optimistic, part of why I've thrown my hat in the ring, is that I genuinely, first of all, there's a disconnect between what people in Gaza think and see and believe versus what people in the West Bank think and believe versus what the Palestinian or Arab or Muslim communities or the pro-Palestine communities in the diaspora, in the Arab world or in Europe or in the US think. There's totally different thought processes. And what's ironic is that we see a lot of misinformed and ill-informed and misguided people in Europe and in America running around with Hamas flags, promoting the resistance narrative, promoting the violence and celebrating October 7. not everybody, but a significant enough number that has become problematic. Meanwhile, the people of Gaza, because they have to experience the consequences of life under Hamas, the consequences of the war that they didn't choose to start and are powerless to stop, they have been turning in mass against Hamas. Not a day goes by without me seeing dozens and dozens of social media posts, information, videos, people that are in Gaza who may be angry with Israel. They are furious with the death and destruction, but they hold Hamas responsible. Mm-hmm. They hold Hamas accountable. They believe that their lives could have been exponentially better without Hamas. And what gives me hope about that is that we're never, I think, going to see a situation in which Hamas or anybody else like Hamas can manipulate the masses into thinking that armed resistance is effective, armed resistance works, that we can destroy Israel. Hamas right now is negotiating for the return of conditions that prevailed on October 6th. There were no Israeli soldiers in Gaza. Gaza was reconstructed. People lived in their homes. And that's all that Hamas is calling for. So why commit the massacre in the first place? So that in and of itself, I think, gives me hope. Now, there needs to be a step further. I mean, and we talk about de-radicalization, which needs to happen in the West and in the United States. It needs to happen in Israel just as much as it needs to happen in the Palestinian society and territories. That said, I think people are a product of their environment. And when and if Gaza is allowed to truly develop without being, you know, stuck between Hamas on one side and Israel on the other side, if there's true prosperity and development, I really sincerely believe people in Gaza will focus on nation building. Gaza can and should, my vision, my, like, what I motivates me, what I work on day in and day out, is to turn Gaza into the crown jewel of the Palestinian people, the pride and joy of Palestinian nationhood, the beating heart of a future Palestinian state. Gaza should never again be a base for violence and terror and attacks against Israel or to support Islamists in northern Sinai. Gaza overlooks the Mediterranean. Gaza could have a seaport and an airport of its own. I flew through Gaza's short-lived airport in 99 and in 2000.
I have a question for later.
So I have full confidence that Gaza could be transformed.
I want to thank you for the answering my question that I had before. I wanted to ask you, how many Palestinians do you know that are empathetic with the Jewish victims of Hamas? Because here in media in Germany and Europe, you don't hear much about that. It's good that you tell me that you have a lot of posts on X or wherever that people say that they are empathetic with the victims of Hamas, Jewish victims.
So one of the challenges, and this is what I'm trying to impress upon a lot of other Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims that I talk to, is that there is space for both people's suffering. There is space for both people's sense of oppression and victimhood. Recognizing the tragedy that took place on October 7 does not eliminate the horror that's happening, does not negate the need to recognize Palestinian suffering. And there is, unfortunately, in public groups and public settings, this need to almost show that you are very pro-Palestine. Sometimes it's sincere, sometimes it's misinformed, and sometimes it's just performative. You need to publicly put on this thing. And I'm not questioning people's intentions, but at the same time, when you speak to them one-on-one, and I have done that time and again and again and again with Palestinians from Gaza and the West Bank, and people here, even in Germany, when I was in Western Germany a few days ago, and I met a lot of Arabs, Palestinians, and Muslims, and some of them, you know, like, really had a skewed understanding of October 7, and there's denialism of a lot of the atrocities that took place. And some people hadn't seen the videos, or they think that the Israelis are fabricating this, or they think that the Israelis killed their own people. And through a process of engage, convince, or confront, those three modalities of communication, I got through to them that some horrendous things happened on October 7. With some of them, it's like, okay, well, that sounds awful, but I still think what's happening in Gaza is worse. Some of them, it's like, okay, that sounds awful, and I'm sorry that they went and experienced that. Does that mean what's happening in Gaza is okay? So it's like this endless process of trying to say, just acknowledging what happened on October 7th in a standalone fashion. You don't have to immediately fight. Like, you can hold space for both. It is entirely possible. Okay. So I think there's a there. And I do think a lot of Palestinians, I have seen it early on in the attack when it was unfolding. I was in the United States, who honestly had a moral issue with bringing young people and children and women as hostages. Some people thought, okay, soldiers, it's a war, like, you bring soldiers, but why are you bringing, so like, there's tiers of it. Some people thought, okay, why did you bring women and children as hostages if you had soldiers? Some people thought it was wrong to attack the kibbutzim, because those are people who employed Gazans. Those are the people who were empathetic. They viewed us as neighbors. And so there's tiers and tiers of it. Unfortunately, amidst the suffering, amidst the horrendous death and destruction of the Gaza Strip, it's difficult for people to verbalize that sense of empathy for the Jewish people.
I have a question, because you posted lately on X, I quote, "Holding all Jewish or Israeli people responsible for the actions of the current Israeli government in Gaza is akin to holding all Muslims responsible for 9/11, ISIS suicides, bombings, and beheading in the name of Islam," end of quote. How many supporters do you have for things that you say, for things like that that you say here? And where are they? Are they more in the US or more in Europe or more in the Near East, in the Middle East?
Well, I think when I frame it in this very specific way, a lot of people are able to take a step back, and it almost puts them on the defensive in the sense of, okay, we don't necessarily hold all the Jewish people responsible for the actions of it. It, like, put to frame it in that way forces people to think critically. I have said repeatedly, while I don't speak on behalf of anyone else, I operate solo, I speak on my own behalf. That said, the sentiments that I share, whether in their totality or in individual slices of them, are held and shared and believed by many Arabs, Muslims, and Palestinians, who often privately cheer me on and say, thank God someone else is saying this. We're grateful that you're saying this. We need diversity of opinions.
Do you have a number of people who criticize you for saying something like that, or who support you for saying it?
Well, it's hard to quantify in the sense, I mean, you better believe I get a lot of attacks against me. I'm sure you've seen them. I'm sure you've seen me. And not just from the pro-Palestine folks. When the pro-Israel community, they love me when I go after Hamas and I go after the terrorism and I go after the damaging elements of the narrative. But then when I criticize the Israeli government, or I criticize Netanyahu or the far right, a lot of people also come after me. But nevertheless, it's hard to quantify. But what I will say is that there are a lot of people who are like-minded, who are unable to speak publicly, lest they be attacked, called Zionists, called traitors, called sellouts. There are a lot of people that think, I mean, one of the things that has helped bolster my credibility is that I am critical of the Israeli government. And I'm while I'm pro-peace and I'm pro-coexistence and I'm pro accountability and agency on the Palestinian side, that doesn't mean I think the Israeli government has had no role in playing this.
I have a question concerning the article that you reposted from New York Times, which is also criticizing something that happened in the Gaza Strip.
Certainly.
It is the three pictures, x-rays of children's heads with bullets of the IDF. This is what New York Time says. But then some other doctors checked out these pictures, and they say that these three alleged x-rays are either blatant fakes, or do not prove what they are supposed to do, because the way they look, the X-rays. They cannot be like that. There had to be tunnels where where it comes in, but they sit there. They just sit there. And this is one question. How do you find out fake news? And if you understand what the other group of doctors says that are not included in the conflict, because the first doctors who claimed this as a war crime, they are involved in the conflict. So the others who are they just checked out the X-rays and said no, it's not possible, this cannot be. And how do you react on criticism to your posts?
So I personally, I mean, do I think personally it is official IDF policy to shoot children in the head? I do not. And I've said that in bits and pieces, and I will say it again. I do not think it is the official policy of the Israeli military. Do I think there are Israeli soldiers at an individual level who do horrible things and take potential pot shots at Palestinians, women, children, or other? Absolutely, I do. So separating that out is important. But I think at the end of the day, I didn't need an X-ray. I mean, I maintain that those incidents, I personally am of the belief that those 2D X-rays are in fact accurate. I do not believe that and I know people in the New York Times who have helped me vet after that post went mega viral of mine. I stand by my individual opinion that those X-rays are accurate and that either they're of low quality, either these children, maybe their heads are so soft that there was no clear entrance wound. I am not a ballistics expert, nor did I claim that. But regardless, even if in fact these X-rays are inaccurate, I have known personally of people that have been in, like my brother who is in Gaza, who runs a major medical NGO, my cousin who is one of the chief surgeons at the European hospital in Gaza, have, with whom I speak regularly, have detailed time and again, instances where civilians were unfortunately hit. Now, going back to your bigger picture question, I know it's difficult to verify some information. I know that there have been some pictures and images that were from Syria or Iraq, and they were shared as if they were from Gaza. I know that, I mean, multiple things can be true at once. There's misinformation out there and attempts to exaggerate, but there's also been this incessant attempt to paint a lot of these stories as Pallywood, which is I think a derogatory kind of awful term that tries to say all the horrors we're seeing out of Gaza are fake because we've seen a few instances where there was misinformation. So therefore, I mean, at the end of the day, some people, no matter what evidence they're presenting, whether pro-Israel or pro-Palestine, the pro-Palestine people, some of them, you literally show them the footage of Hamas murdering and slaughtering Israelis, executing women and burning out people in their bomb shelters. And they'll tell you, oh no, like the Israelis killed their own people. You show some of the pro-Israel people literal tents on fire with people burning, and they'll be like, oh, well, that's fake. Oh, that's from Syria. Or, oh, well, Hamas must have been there. I think, unfortunately, this is how far off the dehumanization has become. And I'm not dismissing that it's difficult to suss out what's accurate and what's not. I'm simply saying this: there's a broader trend at play here.
As long as I work for the subject, there is a gap between Western presentation of news, because you have a democracy, you are reliable of what you say, then to the other side, which is there is a group of people who produces news which are not news, which are just
commentary, you know, commentary and inflammatory and opinions.
I mean, in this area, there is only Arabic or pro-Palestinian
Al Jazeera
and reporters. So I don't know if there is possibility of wie sagt man, ausgeglichen, of a statement that is two-sided.
Well, and I actually think this is part of a folly of the Israeli strategy to not allow journalists into Gaza, Western journalists. I think that, I mean, I don't understand the Israeli rationale there. If you don't let other neutral journalists in to tell the story, it's going to be told in a way that may be skewed one way or another. And I've seen Palestinians in Gaza who are critical of Al Jazeera because, for example, they always start with a Hamas guy shot an RPG. They want to show that Hamas is still fighting. Al Jazeera, Arabic, not English. There's a little bit more standard journalistic standards. Still not wonderful, but Al Jazeera Arabic honestly often is a Hamas propaganda mouthpiece, even though they are the sole source of news that documents what is happening in Gaza. I can watch Al Jazeera Arabic and suss out what's propaganda, what's news, and what's not. I can see visual evidence. It takes practice and unfortunate and knowledge and language. And many people, when they're looking at things on social media, they just hit share. And before you know it, a piece of inaccurate information hits global audiences and it inflames the tensions even further.
Well, the public relations in Israel is not the best.
Mm-hmm. That is an understatement.
We agree on that.
Yes.
There is really a professional public relation on the Arab side because it's very, very focused. That's the point. Mm-hmm. But I would like to know, to come to another theme, to another point. How do you define Zionism? It is a complex theme that is also involving the question of, do you still believe in a two-state solution?
I absolutely do, regardless of what that looks like ultimately. The idea of, I call it the two-nation solution.
Fine.
Two peoples, two nations, two separate, distinct spaces where each of them can express their unique national identity. And so I maintain that while the borders of the two-state solution in a horrendous manner, and I don't support this idea that we can normalize settlements and just say, well, it's a fact on the ground. I do think, for example, I think the right of return should happen to the Palestinian state. I don't think there's going to be millions of Palestinian descendants going back to mainland Israel. That's not going to happen. And I say that to people and they get upset with me. That's not going to happen. However, to make that compromise viable, you need something like the West Bank that can accommodate and give choice to Palestinian refugees and who are in real horrendous conditions in Lebanon and Syria and in parts of Jordan. If you want to come back, have a right of return to a Palestinian state, as long as the borders are defined and what constitutes a Palestinian state. But I think solving the right of return requires having access to the West Bank, which is now unfortunately riddled with settlements that make that difficult. And as long as there is no pragmatic resolution to the right of return. And I look back at the fact that, I mean, people think we're here just because of Zionism. The war in Gaza is happening because of Zionism. The war in Gaza is an extension of 1948. And I take a different approach in that while I understand there's a certain continuity of the conflict, we're here in Gaza because a terrorist organization decided to launch a horrendous attack that was an uncalculated gamble, if you will, that has backfired horrendously in their face. Why wasn't a provisional Palestinian state established between 1948 and 67 in the West Bank and Gaza, and there was East Jerusalem? There were no settlers there. Soon after the Nakba, why weren't Palestinian refugees from Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan repatriated to the West Bank and Gaza? The population size was smaller. There was no settlements. And the land was massive. The right of return could have been solved like that.
And why was it not?
Because the Arab regimes of the time would arrest Palestinian nationalists who tried to establish a Palestinian government in Gaza and in the West Bank, because some, you know, countries wanted, they had low population density and they sort of benefited from the presence of Palestinian refugees, but then they failed to integrate them. This is not solely where we're at right now. Is a combination of, yes, there's certainly Israeli responsibility in some acts. Certainly, I think after 67, perpetuating that occupation indefinitely was a big mistake. However, I think we're also here because of failed Arab policies and leadership, failed Palestinian leadership, realizing that, I mean, we keep, unfortunately, embarking on adventures or defeats. And then after we're defeated or after the setback, we want what we could have already had. And so I'm not letting and another thing real quickly is that Zionism, to me, I've learned through my connection with Jews and Israelis, there's this carte blanche Zionist. It's a big umbrella term under which you had socialist Zionists, you had religious Zionists, you had Zionists that genuinely believed in cohabiting and coexisting rather and living with the native population, the Arab population. This oversimplification of Zionism with a simple brush, I think is not only, I mean, it's become a slur basically to throw Zionists this and that, but it's unhelpful for us to understand why we're here in the first place, us as Palestinians and the pro-Palestine community.
Thank you very much. I want to go back to the question why there is no state yet and what is the input of UNRWA in this field? Because there is the question right now, UNRWA has been not allowed to work from Israel anymore. There is this solution by the Knesset, by the Israeli parliament. On the long run, the UNRWA, the help from the United Nations, this refugee agency only for Palestinians, has made them, in my eyes, like victims. They cannot work wherever, in which state they have been. They have no right to work. In Jordan, yes, I heard somebody who was both Jordanian plus Palestinian plus getting money from the UNRWA. So I don't really understand the concept anymore. But how is it that the UNRWA is now under ceasefire from the Israeli parliament? And could it be a chance that this region is looking for another solution than this organization?
I will say that as much as I've certainly been critical of UNRWA, like the way that this is being done by the current Israeli government and Knesset, I don't personally view that as an opportunity. I have my own critiques and issues with UNRWA, and I believe that there's something to be said about UNRWA's role in potentially perpetuating some aspects of this. But I don't think personally that there's no Palestinian state because of UNRWA. I think there's no Palestinian state because of multiple missed opportunities by Arab and Palestinian leadership. And to walk away from the 2000 Camp David and the Olmert plan in 2008.
Yeah, but the aid made these states in which they have these refugee camps. They earn money from the Palestinians. They didn't give them jobs. They just work with this kind of money from the organization. And they get much more money than the UNHCR, the UNHCR. Yes, because I don't know why.
Well, and part, I mean, I think in a sense, UNRWA prevented the integration of a lot of Palestinian refugees, some of whom live in like true apartheid-like conditions in Lebanon and in parts of Syria and in Jordan. And that's where the policies of the Arab countries and regimes in the past, I mean, it's ironic that now they're like Egypt and Jordan and the United Arab Emirates and the Saudis are totally in a different boat now. There's a realignment, there's a shift. But those countries calculus and policies back then were, we're going to keep you isolated and keep you locked up in these camps for your own good, and you will one day be able to go back and return. And I think that's the delusion that was sold to the Palestinian people. However, again, my whole ethos is multiple truths at once. That can be true while also acknowledging that not only is UNRWA an important lifeline, I actually think there's been an exaggeration in stating that UNRWA is the reason why their Palestinian victimhood and refugeehood is incentivized. I think there can be space for both critiques, or both the critique and the acknowledgement that in the absence of a finalized Palestinian state that has sovereign borders where it can absorb refugees. Because I agree, once you have a Palestinian state, then the issue of refugee needs to basically be folded into the new Palestinian state, where they can decide who lives where based on what.
Yeah, but why not integrate the work that has been done from UNRWA in the UNHCR?
The belief, and I think that's a fair question for some people to ask, why do the Palestinians get their own agency and why do the Palestinians inherit refugee status? I think it was a time and a place for the organization's mandate. I think it was meant to be temporary. And I think this is, again, looking back at this, the historic mistake where we could have repatriated. UNRWA should not exist, would not exist if we had repatriated refugees to the West Bank and Gaza at the time, established a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, and we had East Jerusalem, and let that be that. Instead, pan-Arabism of Nasser, who was flexing his chest and he thought he could attack Israel, and Israel defeated the Arabs, you know, spectacularly. And we are paying, as Palestinian people, the price of that. Because again, Egypt and Jordan were arresting Palestinian nationalists who said, okay, Israel exists, khalas, let's establish a Palestinian state, even if it's transitional in West Bank and Gaza. And the Arabs wouldn't allow that. But going back to UNRWA, I think right now, what concerns me is that trying under fire, under the combat conditions and the war that we see in Gaza, that's part of why the humanitarian conditions are so bad, is that the Israeli government, instead of doing this methodically, used the war and the fact that there were some terrorists who were affiliated with UNRWA. I'm not denying that, but does that then mean all of UNRWA is terrorism? Does that mean, you know, and again, multiple things at once. I think in a sense, UNRWA indirectly allowed Hamas by taking on more of the responsibility for the people of Gaza. It allowed Hamas to say, I'm a government, but I'm not responsible for my people. Let UNRWA, let the UN, let the NGOs take care of them. And I think that indirectly enabled Hamas to entrench its rule. And I think that was harmful to the Palestinian people. But do I think UNRWA's work is bad or that it's not important? Of course not. Do I think there could be reforms where you break up the monopoly of UNRWA controls a lot of the humanitarian work? Could it be parsed out to other UN agencies or other NGOs? Absolutely. I think there is space to be had there. But the UNHCR, to your question, I think unfortunately for some Palestinians, they feel that if you fold UNRWA into UNHCR, then that is a de facto elimination of, well, what do you do with the Palestinian, not just refugees in Gaza and the West Bank, but the refugees in Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. The belief is that UNRWA becomes irrelevant when you come up with a cocktail of compensation, incentives for Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon to absorb these people, repatriation to the West Bank and Gaza, and that can all be negotiated. Or I've talked to Israeli negotiators who were part of the 90s team who talked about an incentive structure and symbolic return of a few Palestinians, compensations, maybe even if the settlements are withdrawn, some or all or whatever from the West Bank. These can be the there's different modalities in which you solve the issue, not just of the refugees in Gaza and West Bank, but most importantly, in the Arab world, because they don't want to be absorbed.
I have another question. I have more, but you have to go.
What time is it now?
It is 20 to 5.
So 20 to 5. To, okay,
we have to the last question.
Yes.
We are talking about refugees who have been living in this area of Israel but have a lot of children now because it's this question of inheritance. How about, is there any discussion about the 800,000 Jews who have lived in Arab countries? I ask this question because when we talk about West Bank, for example, there is the settlements. Is it necessary that all these Jews have to go out from this area? And if so, then it would be a repetition of what happened in the Arab states. Because at the moment, there is space for both, even if there would be Palestinians coming back as refugees. But it's a question and also compensation from these countries where the Jews had to leave after Israel was founded. So there is also a question of who will pay for the rebuilding of Gaza. And, you know, all these questions are still open. So maybe
certainly.
You have...
certainly. No, but like, I'll be honest with you, like, I acknowledge fully, and I have said this repeatedly to many folks, that like there's not enough information among our community about the fact that a lot of the Jewish communities that were, you know, that were sprawling in Iraq, in Syria, in North Africa, in Egypt, who were ultimately forced out. But that was really very much so an Arab community. Like, in a sense, why should the Palestinian people pay? Like, we're already paying for the fact that the Arabs prevented us from going back to the West Bank and Gaza. The Arabs prevented us from building a state in Gaza and the West Bank in 1948. And the Arabs, the pan-Arabism of Abdel Nasser and the anti-Semitism and the anti-Israel and anti-Zionism of that time is what contributed to the forcing of the Arab people, of the Jewish people from Arab lands. So I don't know that it's necessarily a one-to-one comparison in terms of the settlers in the West Bank being somehow morally equivalent to what took place there to the morally wrong displacement of the Jewish people from the Arab world. I also don't believe in kind of like the de facto creating facts on the ground. I mean, there was clear... unambiguous international law and regional arrangements, and the United States and the Europeans, who made it clear to successive Israeli governments, do not expand these settlements. Okay, fine. Like, we reached the Oslo years. Why did the settlements expand after the, you know, like, okay, fine. Hamas, like, we pulled out of Gaza, but why didn't the settlements like end up to a certain point where you could do territorial swaps? And they kept expanding and expanding and expanding and taking new territories. And there's tiers. Some of them are settler, are economic settlers. Some of them are ideological settlers. They're not all monolithic. I understand that. Some of them are really violent settlers that we see right now terrorizing the Palestinians. So like, I don't think it's fair to just say, okay, well, this is what exists on the ground. This is the fact. And we just have to live with it. And there's not going to be, you know, the other thing, too, is it's a matter of contiguous Palestinian statehood. And I understand there are many settlers and settlements that are not going to be pushed out, and they will eventually be annexed by Israel. But then do you do territorial swaps? Do you create enough of a geographic depth so that the Palestinian Authority, and the state of Palestine, forget the authority for now, is what we have. The Palestinian nation can have sovereignty, control, can invite, you know, what if other Palestinians want to make Aliyah, their own version of Aliyah to the state of Palestine? I think there needs to be space for that. By the way, the folks in Lebanon, for example, I talked to a lot of Christian Lebanese who are very like, we want peace with Israel. But because of their history with the Palestinians, they feel strongly that peace with Israel will only come when the Palestinian refugees are repatriated somehow, somewhere. I think...
Yeah, okay. I agree to a certain point, not to everything, because I think that if the settlers would agree to be as a Palestinian with a Jewish religion in the Palestinian state, there should be a thinking about
I've
that.
I've said so publicly, yes. But I still think at the end of the day, like, there's a certain form, like, there are some lands that, like, where a bunch of 20 guys, they build these outposts. Yeah. Like those ones are the most egregious because that's my land. I am farming here and you come and push me out.
This has to end. This aggression has to end.
Certainly.
The settlers has to. And I wanted to say in Lebanon and in other areas where there is even a refugee camp in Gaza and there is one in Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. I was there. Mm-hmm. And it's, for me, it's not understandable that there is refugee camps within the Palestinian.
Exactly.
And in Lebanon, they have they just have to tear down to my simple thinking, tear down the fences, give them work, and they will agree to live there in Lebanon, maybe.
But I think there needs to be separation between in the Palestinian territories versus in the Arab lands and in Lebanon, Syria, or Jordan. But in the Palestinian territories, they call them camps, the refugees, because they actually started as actual camps. My mom and dad were born in camps that were literal tents in the early 50s. And over time, these camps got built up a little bit. They got a little asbestos. UNRWA brought in some modular homes. And then boom, 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 decade. So it's like you have within Gaza Strip, you have several camps that, again, started as camps. Now, the theory is that when there's a Palestinian state, these will absolutely no longer be camps. They might be called that, but that these will be Palestinian citizens who are living in Gaza and in the West Bank. And I think the negotiations in Oslo, I think the vision is very much so that that would be the case, but absent a resolution, unfortunately, that it remains elusive and we will be stuck here. But I want to leave on a positive note, just a really positive note. In the short term, things are grim. We don't know when the war is going to stop. Tomorrow is the U.S. election. By the time this airs, I imagine the results will be known. But about Gaza and specific to Gaza, I genuinely see a shift in which the totality of the people's attitudes, coupled with the fact that there will no longer ever be somebody like Hamas who can fool people or delude them into thinking that armed resistance is going to finish off Israel or eliminate it or weaken it or erase it or do anything other than bring disaster upon us. I see a shift in which the people of Gaza, forget what's happening in Europe and in America and in the West Bank and the Arab world, in Gaza itself, which is the battleground, the people have had enough of Hamas. They've had enough of being pawns. The totality of those things that I'm seeing, the shifts in the attitude, make me confident that this will be Gaza's final war. And what I've been calling on is that we don't just reconstruct Gaza. Reconstruction happens as part of rejuvenation and a renaissance, so that Gaza becomes the beating heart of a future Palestinian state. Unfortunately, this is coming 20 years later after the withdrawal in 2005, which, however imperfect, was an opportunity to show what an occupation-free West Bank would look like, that Palestinians are capable of effective self-governance, which I believe we are. We just have the worst leaders. We have a lot of mid-level leaders and professionals and academics and technocrats and bureaucrats whom I don't know their names and you don't either. But when people are like, who could govern Gaza? Who could rule? In the medium term, if you empower those people, I absolutely believe they will absolutely perform fantastical miracles in terms of effective self-governance, nation building, and focusing on turning Gaza into the pride and joy of the Palestinian people.
With the idea of an airport that you are going to work
Inshallah. On. Yes, an airport and a seaport, but definitely an airport.
Lovely idea. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Out of time, but I really appreciated talking to you, and I really like the ideas that you have given to us.
Thank you. We have to keep the conversation going. Thank you for having me. Cheers.
Eine Produktion von MENA Watch, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns. Eine Produktion von MENA Watch, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. besuchen Sie uns.